Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sheila Shaw again, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to Army man Ray Goggins.
What do you think you've learned most from your life in the Army in private security?
Being calm.
Okay.
If you remain calm, it's a superpower. It's an absolute superpower for you, first of all, and for everybody around you after that. So when you have a situation where it's like meltdown and there's like madness around you, just people dying, whatever it is, if you can just take that half a second, 2 seconds, to just calm yourself, whatever your techniques is to do that, and instead of having a reaction, have a response. And understand that difference. And it, you first, don't worry about everybody else around you. Take that couple of seconds, get yourself ready, and then, as I said earlier, take that one step, take the next step. Purpose, the small little details, concentrate on that, then you build your confidence. It'll get better, get better, get better. That's what I've learned. So being calm is the key factor in your life.
Ray served in the Irish Army for 26 years, including 17 years in the Army Ranger Wing, and he now spends a lot of his time working with corporate teams in his role as director of training and leadership company Core Skills. Originally from Cork, he lives in Kildare with his wife Sinead and their two kids, Dan, who's 13, and Louisa, who's 10. And in this conversation, we talk about his book, Ranger 22, and the recent success of hit TV show Special Forces Ultimate Hell Week. He also shares the best advice he ever got, and he speaks about the power of staying calm in any situation. And I started the chat by asking him about Ultimate Hell Week and how close it is to the real experience.
Yeah, it's as close as we can make it. Like, you have to understand the mindset for guys going on. The real one is, like, people ask, I hear people saying about the show, why would people do that?
Yeah.
In the real one, in the military, you do that because that's your entry test to get into special forces. So you have to go through that process. So that's why guys do it. For the civilian one and for the professionals, like, it just shows the caliber that they are, that they would do it. Like, there's no monetary bonus for them. There's particular, they might get a pat on the back if they do get through. So it just shows why. But it is as close as we can make it to the real thing. Obviously, there's no kind of threat involved. There's no military. There's no tactics. There's no, like, weapons training, communication stuff. Yeah. All the stuff that you need to learn to be an operator. So we don't have all that. And we can't really put pressure on them tactically.
Okay.
But we do all the other stuff. So we do, like, it's all mindset. It's all self-belief. It's all about commitment. And they're the three things we target for the whole show.
And you always talk about that, you know, at the end of the day, physically we have a breaking point. Mm. But then what takes over is the mindset, is what's in your heart and soul, and
absolutely,
that keeps you going.
Yeah, so it is. And what people have said to me previously is, look, you break them down. And I'm saying, no, we don't break them down. We're trying to pull the best out of them completely. And they don't even realise what their best is.
Yeah.
Yes, they were all athletes and they performed at the highest levels for whatever event they had, and they trained hard for it. But they didn't have that experience of having five complete days, like of 24-hour days almost, where they're completely pressurized. So then you go into a different part of yourself in that environment. So you find reserves of strength and power that you never thought you had. All of them.
Yeah, and I suppose people, like, you know, throw themselves into different situations, be it like going on a retreat to kind of get to know yourself a bit better, or just stepping out of your comfort zone in whatever way. I suppose this is an extreme form of it, but you probably really do meet yourself and get to know what you're really made of.
Yeah, you do. And like I coined a phrase on the show that people would, you know, we'd be in their souls. And that's not just like a tagline for the crack.
Mm.
It's you actually are, because to pass that course, you absolutely have to bare your soul completely and who you are, regardless of your fitness and what you've done. So that's what the people who, even if people don't get to the end, the people who get the most out of that experience are the people who are most themselves and get into themselves the most and bring the most.
It didn't seem like there was any room for ego. I mean, there wouldn't be in the real deal anyway.
No, there isn't. People think you're all these. Look, don't get me wrong. There is a certain amount of like chest beating and gorilla stuff, which gets you through certain environments. But it's not all about that. So you learn that like you're only as good as your last mistake, really. So you need to learn from those things. And like guys' ego, when they come in as young operators, yeah, of course, they're full of beans and stuff. But it gets pared down as they get through operations and missions, and they realize that it's about that bond. And actually, vulnerability is a good part of it as well, because you know exactly what you're good and bad at. And like you can step into that zone then with other guys, because you know you're in form today, so you're carrying the team. You mightn't be good tomorrow. One of your colleagues will be good. He'll sort something out. So that's the way it works. So that's why the ego thing is kind of pared down very much. Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear you say that about vulnerability, because I suppose, you know, on paper, you wouldn't necessarily think that. You think it's all about like bravado and you know, putting your best foot forward. But it is important to know where your own weaknesses are. And we all have them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you don't know what you're weak at or what you're afraid of, like you can't excel. It's impossible, because you'll keep on avoiding those things.
Okay.
Or you'll hide those things, or you'll bluff about them.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm not into that. Where you need to, I won't say meet them head on, but you need to start taking bits of them and taking it away and realize, you know, you can get it to a position where you're comfortable with a fear or something you're not good at. But if you know, like, for example, I'm a team leader of six guys. Yeah. I'm not good at like parachuting or something, for example. Like, so I would use other guys for that asset, or someone else to take the lead on that.
Okay,
for
I getcha. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, and you learn that over time, and you learn that if you do make an absolute mess of something, like it's okay. Like once you move on, move on.
Well, let's talk about all the stuff that you are good at, because there's a long list. The book is Ranger 22, and I suppose we saw it in the TV show that everybody, you know, left their name at the door and they became a number. So you did the training at the beginning. I think you'd only been like in the army maybe 2 years or so when you did the training first. So you were a young lad, what, early 20s?
I was early 20s, yeah.
Okay, and didn't go according to plan?
No, it didn't. It was, you look, again, it was lack of experience on my part. I was young, fit, strong, even though, you are tested to a certain degree in the regular army. Obviously, look, I was, you know, my fitness and my ability, I was at probably 75%. I was never tested completely.
Yeah.
So I decided I'd try these guys because I'd seen them at what they call a roadshow. They come around in the bandwagon, you know, hooking fellas in like the Pied Piper, and everyone,
everyone
follows them up to the car and gets killed. So I followed them up to the car.
Right. And, thinking I'm this.
Yeah,
this
I'm the man. Like, sure, this is great. Like, I'm fit. And I thought, sure, I'm fit. That's all I need to be able to do.
Yeah,
I'm the
push-up
champion. No, absolutely not. So your fitness leaves you extremely quickly.
Right, yeah.
And then, as we said earlier, you're down to heart and soul. And for me, what let me down on the first time round was I didn't believe in myself enough for a start. So, you know, I started worrying about things. You know, they're going to make me do this. They're going to make me do that. Like, and I was trying to think about things that were completely outside my control. And, you know, in a pressurized environment, or to be resilient, if you start worrying about stuff you can't affect, then you're straight away on the back foot.
Yeah.
So the whatever bit of kind of self-belief and kind of opinion I had of myself has been undermined constantly. So that was probably a big part of it. Secondly, I hadn't committed to it completely. I kind of said to myself, look, I'll try it out instead of going, look, I'm passing this no matter what, which is what the attitude I should have had
going
up. And the final thing was preparation for me. I didn't prepare enough to get ready for it. So there were the three reasons I believe I didn't pass the first time around.
And I believe afterwards, you know, the instructors, the people involved were kind of saying, look, you were doing good.
Yeah, I was actually shocked. One of the main instructors there who was running the course is an extremely senior officer now in the military. He's at the top level. And we only spoke about this again recently because we still have a friendship. I worked with him later on, but you know, like when you're in that zone where you think, oh, I'm struggling here, I'm barely hanging on, like, you know, you're starting to doubt yourself, that voice in your head is getting louder and louder and louder to quit. Mm. And your reason why you're doing it isn't as strong enough, you know. So then I went in to talk to him as my kind of leaving interview, and he was like, he was couldn't believe it. I was going, you know, I was going, Jesus, if I just got that hint 12 hours before, maybe it'd push me on. But again, that's the whole idea of the process in the show and in the military. You have to do it for yourself. You can't. The instructors can't do it. The teachers can't do it for you. You got to do it. So. Mm.
And maybe everything has its time and place.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think emotionally I was ready for it either, even if I had passed that phase of it, like, emotionally.
You're so young.
Yeah, but even, look, it's not... I was emotionally immature at the time, I guess. Like, I know guys who've passed selection at 19.
Okay, all right.
They're focused, they're prepared, they're ready to go. Actually, a very good friend of mine that I did selection with was only 19 doing it.
Go away.
And... Like a granddad, totally focused,
okay,
beyond his years. Great guy. For me at the time, no. I'd have been a living to do first before I was ready for some.
So you came back, what, 7 or so years later?
Yeah, 7 years later, yeah. So kind of on a roundabout kind of way.
And at that stage, like, you had already achieved a lot in your military career.
Yeah, I was serving in Cork at the time in the infantry. I got to myself in a position of trust, like junior rank as an NCO, where I was responsible for like training people and leading teams and so on and so forth. Mm. Had done some operations overseas, which were great experience and great crack, with lads from the west of Ireland as well. I could have probably easily have stayed in that place comfortably and had a pretty good career, you know. Like, I'd have, you know, I'd have made rank easier. I'd have probably ended up retiring at a higher rank and all that kind of stuff. But it was always in the back of my head like that, you know. It was calling me.
Right.
It was calling me, like, always there. And eventually I kind of set conditions correctly. It was actually after my father passed away the year before I went on selection. I said to myself, right, life is too short here. Mm. I've been kind of... This has been a mission for me-ish for years, and I've been getting ready for it, but with no actual plan to really go and do it. And I said, okay, this is the time to do it. So for that year after my father passed away, I just trained completely for selection and went on it.
Do you think that, you know, the fact that you were grieving the death of your dad, and that gave you maybe an extra bit of focus, bit of drive?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Like, I had a few major issues in my life that year before it. And, you know, a huge one immediately before it, where I split from my wife, unfortunately, at the time.
Yeah.
Which was, like, traumatic. So it was within days of the course. So for me, that put me in a position where I had no choice. So, like, there was basically a gun put to my head, as far as I was concerned, to pass that course. Because, you know, my life in Cork, and I was very happy there, had changed completely. So the life I lived was probably over.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, so I had nowhere to go, really. So I had to pass it.
You
in
just
my head.
Threw yourself into it.
I used that as a positive because, like, you know, I just focused completely on what I could do to make it better. So I was saying, look, yeah, if I have to go back to Cork, I'll have to deal with this, this, and this, and this. But if I go up here to these lads, then it'll be a new life. And that's basically what I did. It just changed my life.
So if it's not too personal, what was the time frame from? Because I know you were married 2 years.
Yeah.
Just two years. From your dad passing away to the breakdown of your first marriage.
Okay.
What was the timeline?
It was less than a year.
Okay, that's intense. That's a lot to contend with.
Yeah, it was. It was tough at the time, but again, you know, it gave me focus because I remember sitting in the house days before I went on selection when all this was going on, and I got to that moment and I said, look, there's kind of two ways I can do this.
Yeah.
I can just like kind of keel over and just, you know, fall apart, or I can focus now on this mission, which I did.
Yeah.
Which I did. And it worked out. It worked out great, you know.
Yeah. And also, you come from a long line of army people.
Yeah.
Your dad, your granddad, your great-grandfather.
Yeah, and beyond. So,
wow.
And it was something that was kind of quietly, I won't even say quietly spoken about. I knew my father was in the military, obviously, because he'd been in the Congo. And he retired by the time I came along. So never really spoke about the army. Never went back to the barracks. Had no old army friends would call around. So you might get the odd story. I was a devil for going through old photographs, digging them out, and I'd be finding pictures of him in the Congo. Like I said, it was a picture of him with this kind of like a helmet that you'd see in a Tarzan movie.
Okay.
And a monkey.
Right.
And I'm going, who's this fella? Like, where does this come from? It's a great picture.
Yeah.
So I used to ask him about the army constantly, and he'd tell me a few stories, but not in major. But then after he died, then...
that's typical. as well.
It is typical, isn't it? It's an Irish thing, yeah, absolutely.
And but also, I would imagine there's so much of in terms of what you do, that's quite secretive.
Yeah.
That you don't talk about.
Well, that's probably it too, I suppose, for his time. Like, that was long before Special Forces came around in the Irish Army. And
sure.
But, like, I suppose most soldiers are like that. You just, an Irish...
You get on with it.
You do, and you don't bring home big war books and stuff. That's just me. I don't want to do that so far. But, yeah, the thing about my father was, like, he never spoke about his father in the military ever. And I actually didn't know my grandfather served in the Great War until after my father died.
Okay,
because
wow.
I'd found a medal and did some digging and so on and so forth. And then, you know, I did a bit of more digging and I found my great-grandfather had served and was actually an Offaly man, which I couldn't believe.
Okay.
Because I have a couple of good Biffo friends that I continually
yeah.
slag.
Yeah, okay.
So then I realised I had Biffo blood as well. So it's a bit of a trauma for me.
I love it.
Yeah.
So. You'd be a great contender for that show, Who Do You Think You Are?
Possibly, yeah.
The genealogy
yeah.
show, yeah. yeah. But you've already...
they'd have to bluff it because I know all the answers now.
yeah, exactly. So how far have you gone back?
I've gone back to like the early 1800s.
Have you? Wow.
To Moneygall in Offaly.
All right.
Where my great-grandfather was born.
So you're practically Barack Obama's cousin.
Yeah, they're, sure. There you yeah. go. Like, that's where I was just destined for great things. Myself and Barack are on the same boat here. Yeah.
Love it.
Deadly.
So this is now, what, 1997, 98?
Yeah, so my father passed away in 98, went on selection in 99.
Right.
So the following year then, and that was kind of like September.
Can you explain the process, the training?
Okay.
So what we see on TV is getting you geared up, Maria, for the selection wing
yeah.
of the Army Ranger training.
Yeah.
Excuse my ignorance.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Right.
You're actually very accurate.
Am I?
yeah.
So in real life, how long does the training take?
Okay. So the old way, there's a different syllabus now. It takes like nearly a year now for a guy to get trained.
Right.
Like from start to finish, or flash to bang, as we call it. When I did my one, so you do like a 4 weeks of that kind of stuff you see in the show, which is just like mayhem and you're just being killed constantly for 4 weeks. Then you get a week break and then you go into a 6 month training regime, which is teaching you to be a ranger, basically.
Okay.
The first 4 week phase is what we used to coin the phrase, you put the monkeys up the tree, you shake the tree and you see what monkeys followed. So it's all physical, wet and cold, hungry, no sleep, all the stuff you see on TV, but for 4 weeks.
And the failure rate is really high.
It's incredibly
at this stage.
High. Yeah, yeah. Like my first course that I mentioned that I failed on, there was something like 128 of us started. I think like 9 guys got through in the end.
Wow, right.
And what's funny, when I quit, the guy who was my buddy, very good guy, called Sean, as I left and was trying to talk me out of not going, come back 7 years later when I'm on selection. He was one of my instructors.
All right.
So it was great. And loved putting the boot in me. It was fantastic, which is another Irish thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but for me then, that year, that training, for me, I was lucky because I had been put on a physical training instructor's course in the Curra for 6 months. So I was learning how to train all the time and I was, you know, evenings free. So I trained. On the weekends, I'd go home. And the thing about selection is you need to build your leg strength for carrying all the heavy equipment in the mountains. So like running around, and you know, isn't going to do that for you. You need to get into the hills with kit on. So every weekend, I used to meet a friend in the Galtees. We used to walk the length of the Galtees. So we'd walk on a Saturday, camp out and walk back on a Sunday. So that's like 50 miles of walking, just a bit of leg strength. So that's what I was, that's where my focus was, because, you know, after my father had passed away, I decided, look, yeah, this is where I'm going. This is where I want to be. Like.
So you're training physically. How do you train psychologically?
Yeah, so, yeah, to build your self-belief. Your self-belief comes from knowledge and your self-belief comes from your own ability, your experiences and what you learn. So I found out by taking on kind of, like I built it compared to my first course in that intermediate 7 years I had served overseas. I'd led patrols. I'd been involved in various situations where I realized, okay, I can do this. I can lead these guys. I can, you know, I can affect this positively.
Mm.
So that had a big effect on me. To get ready for selection then, what builds your self-confidence is obviously your fitness, your knowledge of military kind of, you know, navigation, communications, weapons training, you know, all the stuff I'd be tested on. So I was going through, you know, repeat training that constantly. The kind of psychological side of that then, preparing yourself for the adversity, is hard to do. So what I used to do is get friends of mine to run like a training event for me as a surprise.
Okay.
So get me off guard, you know. It could be anything. So I just turn up for it. It could be anything.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mental,
yeah. But like, yeah. But you have to, like, the thing about the preparation side of it, like, it's key because, you know, I was lucky that I knew exactly why I had failed the first time round. And I knew the three things I was weak on, that I could target those. And that's what I did. And then as I discovered, once we went on operations, real ones, that the hardship goes off the scale then on those, because you can't put your hand up and say, look, I've enough, I'm over
here. Yeah.
You're in a real operation somewhere where people's lives are in your hands and so on. And you have to absolutely give everything. Like, so that's the way it works. That's the reality of it.
Mm, of course. Well, I mean, I say, of course, I don't have a clue, let's be honest.
But it is, like, in any life, you know, no matter what we do in our lives, like, there's certain things we need to do, like, whether you want it or not. I suppose the whole special forces thing is that extreme part of it. And, like, all the values are very similar. Like, look at those athletes, what they brought and those core values they bring. We have the same values. We have the same core things that we work on. We just do it at a kind of an extreme level and maybe a more extreme focus.
Yeah, you know?
So that's probably the only difference.
More extreme than what we saw on telly.
Yeah, like,
it's gas.
Absolutely.
I was like, how can it get more extreme?
It does. Oh, Jesus, it does.
Yeah, it does.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what did it feel like? So you said, like, you know, first time around, out of over 100 or whatever the number was, only about 9 got through the first 4 weeks. How many got through to selection? And at the end of that process, knowing that you made it, what did that feel like?
There's no words to describe it. Like, there was, on my course, there was 8 of us got through. As guys, there was 2 in that day. There was actually 10 of us in total, but officer guys from the officer corps is a different system. They have to go off and do other stuff. So there was 8 of us went to the unit, and that link with those 8 guys, even to now, like, they're akin to brothers. The 8 of us, like, we're all over the world now doing different things, but we meet up once a year. We're, you know, WhatsApp, we're always talking, chatting, because we have that bond. But that feeling of, like, even that first phase of 4 weeks I mentioned, where you cross the line. And you do a marathon at the end of it, right, with all your kit on, with about, like, 120 pounds of kit.
And, what?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and this is on the back of all the other stuff you've done?
This is the end of the 4 weeks, yeah. And
wow.
So you do that. That's your finished thing. It's, they call it the walk back. And then you get back to the Ranger headquarters. And, like, it's a bit surreal for a while because, you know, it's kind of within seconds it's finished. And you're kind of going, Jesus. And, like, people are congratulating you, but trying to soak it in takes a long time. Like, it probably took me a couple of weeks to soak it in, to be honest. You know, really.
I can only imagine, yeah.
Yeah. And then you're in there and, like, you're, you know, the next phase, then you get a week off where I couldn't walk really for the week. And I remember one of my sisters saying to me about, like, you know, I was, like, sleeping probably 20 hours a day and waking up and just eating all the time.
Yeah.
I just had, like, actually the bed where I was sleeping, I just had loads of food next as I woke up. I just eat and then go back to sleep.
Yeah.
And then after your week's rest, then you go back and you're on a kind of a recovery phase for the first 3 weeks because you're all broke up.
Sure.
We're like a load of old men bouncing around. So, you know, the physical training is easy. It's a lot of lecture based for the first couple of weeks to get you back in. And then when your body is good, then again, they go at you then again.
Again.
But not always as intense as you see on the show.
Uh-huh.
But phases of it where it gets brought up to that for a week and then maybe brought back down, something else up, down. And
then how quickly were you put into action?
Yeah, really quickly, because we are kind of what's called... It used to be called skills training back then, was kind of curtailed because we had a live operation where the unit was deployed to East Timor.
Mm.
And we were going to be heading out there as well. So we were kind of, I did almost some of my skills training in Timor. So we went to the jungle for 5 months, which is brilliant because, like, you know, I had served in Lebanon 4 times at this stage, you know. And, like, yeah, it is pretty extreme and a pretty dangerous place, but it's like a garrison, really. You're in a kind of a base, you know. It's very kind of structured, very routine based, as dangerous as I said. But the whole jungle thing, living in the jungle in monsoon in a tent and, like, patrolling in the jungle, like, that experience was phenomenal. Like, you know, it was great crack.
It just sounds like a movie.
But, like, a really kind of, it looked like The Mission. It was on recently there and RT, I was watching it, and that rain, there's a scene in the jungle, the rain, and it just brought me back to Timor, because when it rains there, it's like being in the shower.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
It's mental, like, and nothing, it's impossible to be dry, impossible.
Yeah,
but it's good,
yeah,
though, you just get on it. It's a bit of crack as well.
I love a bit of crack.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So how do you think your dad would have felt about you, you know, becoming an Army Ranger?
I think he'd have been, he wouldn't have said much. He was quite a calm individual. I think once you just do your best and get on with it, he'd be happy enough, because that's the way he was. He was a very composed, calm man. If you got things wrong, never really bothered him, you know. Never really bothered. Now, if you stood in front of the telly when Man United were playing, that might bother him, you know. But in general, no.
Yeah, okay.
I think he'd have been pretty happy, I guess, yeah.
So was he a man to kind of hold back in terms of criticism and praise, or?
No, he'd praise you very quickly.
Okay.
And he'd temper his criticism very well. He was the kind of man where you would hate to have him criticize you at all. Like,
okay.
For me, I would dread, even if he wouldn't even have to say anything, if you've done something and you made a mess of something, like even that walking in to see him, he'd say nothing, he wouldn't say anything to you, you just feel gutted, like you let him down, or you know what I mean, so on. So I always found with that quiet, I won't say disdain, that's not fair, that quiet kind of
disappointment.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah, like,
I think a little bit. I think a lot of people will, you know, we don't have to be in the military to appreciate that disappointing a parent can sometimes be far more difficult to take than when they're screaming and roaring at you.
Yeah.
When they're disappointed with you, that's harder.
Yeah, it is. Like, and the thing about it as well, he was just so kind of nice about it. That's just what made it worse. You'd prefer if he showed it at you, like, or gave you a clout or something, but he did. He never did.
Yeah. Okay, so like your career has obviously spanned, I think, was it 26 years in the Army?
In the Army, and then like, I suppose if you look in at the private security stuff, another 4 or 5, and then a couple of years in the FCA before that. So like, I was a soldier from 15, really.
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
And now you're obviously in a completely different zone, because I suppose your entire career was, a lot of it was shrouded in secrecy, because it was the nature of the work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Don't talk about it.
No.
First rule of Fight Club.
You
don't talk about it. And here you are now with the book. Is there a bit of a... Was that a difficult decision to make?
Yeah, it was. And to be honest, like, it wasn't my idea about the book. It came off the back of the show, I guess. And like, the good people at Guilds gave me a shout and said, look, would you be interested in doing it? And I was kind of... So like, I was kind of, you know, I was out of the shallow, as the song goes, at this stage.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. So I started writing stuff. And like, there were certain people I had to contact, of course, because... Like, yeah, there's loads of interesting stuff I could talk about.
I'm sure there's plenty in the book that isn't in the book that could have been.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So like, the challenge was what message I wanted to get across and how I could get it across.
Uh-huh.
So like, I didn't want it to be like another war book or something like that about, like, you know, like, not that they're a dime a dozen, but like, you get guys from British guys, Americans, German, they're all writing those left, right and center and fighting huge wars left, right and center. So I was never going down that road. But I was interested in the fact that, like, I made contact with my former unit, for example, for the RW, and, you know, had a certain link with them to, look, this is what's going to happen a few months out from it.
Yeah.
This is what I'm doing, and got their kind of blessing a little bit, the same, the Department of Defense a little bit. Anyone I worked for in the likes of Afghanistan, stuff like that. Because, like, it's a very small community, like, and a few... Like, and it still is. I'm very much involved in that community with people, and a few kind of, like, it's like where you're from in the west of Ireland, like, you know, everyone knows everyone and people have a certain kind of way, and if you're going to do something that might cause offence, you just might tip people off first.
Of course.
And it's always easier.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got great support then as well from everyone about it, so it was great.
How do you find this newfound fame?
Oh jeez, I wouldn't say fame, no. You sound like my wife be laughing at this.
There is an element of that.
And I'm not being all modest by saying, oh, there's not. No, I get it. Like, and look, after the first shows, people recognise us a little bit. It's a lot more now, obviously, yeah, because of the book and everything else. But like, I think I'm dealing with it well because, like, people are very good about it. You know, no one has put it up to me yet and whipped their T-shirt off to fight me or anything like that so far. Yeah. But people are very good. I'm happy to talk to people. Strangely enough, people think because I'm this person on the show that, oh, Jesus, don't talk to him. He's a nut job. Like, I can be a nut job, but
the gas thing is, when I met you outside, straight away, what hits you in a split second is how just warm you are.
Yeah.
And I was speaking, I only realised when I went to the loo before the chat, I was speaking a million miles a minute. That's me being slightly intimidated.
Yeah, yeah.
But weirdly, I had no reason to be.
You
because you have such a lovely, natural way about you. But I've been glued to the TV show, yeah, you see, for weeks, watching you be a bit mental. And yeah, I'm thinking, oh, Jimper, I'm going to meet Ray.
Yeah.
Meet Ray in person.
Oh, don't worry. He's there too. That fella's always,
yeah, okay,
there. Yeah, but like, not straight away. Not straight away.
When do you bring him out in real life?
Rare enough, I guess. Like, but it's even the focus of it and the kind of the composure of it with him, you know,
right, that's what with him, I love him, yeah, it.
But like,
does he have a name?
No, it's me. It's just, all me. There's no like,
just another,
there's no kind of psycho in it. It's just you're in that zone of training and testing these guys. So that's who you are like in that time. Look, yeah, when I'm putting my young lad, when I'm almost a discipline him, or when we're doing stuff at home or giving out to someone, that guy is there as well, like, you know.
Well, let's talk about your kids, because you did say it before we start chatting as well. I don't know how we were talking about kids and discipline and different things, and you were saying you put him in the plank position.
Yeah, yeah, I do, yeah, because I found like that at his age profile and kids, like he's
13
now, yeah, my daughter's 10, and like, you can give out all you want. They don't hear a lot of it, like,
okay,
you know. So you need to put them in, like, it's like the show. We get that stuff into their soul because we put them in a position where they'll hear you. You know what I mean? They're not. So what I do with him, and it worked out perfectly, I'd put him in the plank. Done that probably when he was about 10. I'd get in the plank with him. And
right,
we'd go face to face and we'd chat about what he did or didn't do. And it was effective because he's actually listening then. He's not giving out. He's not moaning about it. And hopefully by the end of the minute and a half or whatever, there's a bit of an understanding. And if there isn't, then you reset and go again.
Okay.
Or not, you know. But like,
so you'll keep doing it until he learns a lesson.
Yeah, but he has. Like, it doesn't happen very often. He's quite a calm individual. He's very relaxed, and he's actually too relaxed. Like, sometimes you wonder, is there a pulse at all? Like, he's totally chilled out.
Laid back.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you see that he might follow in your footsteps?
Yeah, if he wants to, great. If he doesn't, great.
Cool.
So I'm the same with my daughter, whatever they want to do. Like, it doesn't mean he has to put on the boots like everyone down the line with the ancestors. It's up to him what he does, you know. It'd be great either
way. When you were a young lad, how quickly did you aspire to being in the army?
I don't remember thinking about anything else.
Oh, really?
Ever.
Wow.
So we used to go to Butlins as kids in the 70s and, you know, the old chalet process and running around the muck and people around are out playing. There was a huge pitch and putt course and I used to be over playing like war in the bunkers.
So,
you know, people are trying to knock golf balls around and I'm crawling around the place, you know, getting ready, playing. So, yeah, but it was always in my head.
So it was in your bloodline?
I think so, yeah, I think so. And if I hadn't a military lineage, I don't know. It was just in my DNA.
You know, we look at, as normal people, and I'm speaking from, you know, as myself and other people listening who don't have experience of it, as it's a real vocation, I suppose, the type, you know, being in the military, being a soldier, and you probably give up an awful lot.
Yeah, you do, like other jobs, you know, like, you know, people in medics, emergency services, all those people who, like, you know, NGOs, people who travel off helping other people. It definitely is, like, and there's probably certain grades of it you can do, like, obviously the more you go up, that's unfair to say so. In the regular army, you probably get more time at home, bar on overseas missions, but once you go to special forces, like, you're on call 24/7, you know, even when you're in Ireland, you're operation all the time. If you're not training, you're on an operation. And then when you do deploy somewhere, like, you're away. So I'll just give you an example. When I was my first overseas trip, I was 19. And I mentioned it in the book. There was no phone calls and all this kind of stuff. So I was just writing letters.
Yeah.
So I was trying to explain this to my 10-year-old daughter recently, that she was going, like, why don't you just text? And why don't you just do a WhatsApp call or a video call?
Mm.
And I'm trying to explain they didn't exist. So you're getting, like, you know, it's like you see in the movies, the mail call and the post comes in once a week, you know, so it's a huge part of it. But I suppose to answer your question, yeah, like, all the service people put, it's a huge sacrifice for the families as well, because they got to put up with a lot of stuff at home.
Sure.
Like, my wife, you know, all the times I was away, and even as I worked as a private security contractor, you know, she wouldn't be able to ring me if I was doing certain jobs. I'd be off the grid for maybe a couple of days, and, you know, whatever happens, happens, and that's it. She'd have to deal with it, or, you know, deal with all the normal day-to-day madness and even some crisis stuff herself, you know what I mean? So,
was it hard to adjust to life back, you know, back home afterwards?
Yeah, I found it difficult sometimes, to be honest, because, like, the pressure of, for me, like, for I'll use Afghanistan as an example. I spent the best part of 3 years in Afghanistan as a private security contractor. So my life was broken down into a year where I'd, every 2 months, I'm in Afghanistan for 2 months, I'm home for a month, Afghanistan 2 months, home for a month. So that kind of cycle for four times a year. So for me, flying into Kabul, my mindset, you know, you're getting ready for work. You're hoping the plane doesn't get shot down on the way in for a start. That was always kind of a worry. So you get in there. I'm in the mindset, picked up, ready to go into what, into your job, into protecting people. I found that very easy to get into because I knew what to do, and, you know, and life becomes very simple. All you're worried about is safety, protecting people, protecting yourself. I don't have to worry about, like, the school run. I don't have to worry about paying the mortgage. I don't have to worry about someone being sick, going to the dentist, all that stuff. So it becomes very simple.
But, and you're trained, so you kind of go into it's muscle memory.
Yeah,
exactly. You know what to do.
Yeah, so everything's quite simple, very straightforward, very structured process. So on the other hand, then flying out of Afghanistan, which would be brilliant, always a great high, delighted with yourself, fantastic. Going home for a month off, like, who gets 4 weeks off, four times a year, fantastic.
Yeah.
So we could do loads of stuff, but I was always kind of conscious on the leg. I'd fly into Dubai, fly home then to Ireland, and on the 8-hour flight to Dublin, sometimes I was as nervous as when I was flying into Kabul in a different way because, like, you know, Sinead would meet me at the airport with the lads, like, with the kids, and it'd be brilliant. And I'd be so excited and so happy. But, like, there was different kids every 3 months, you know, because they'd grow. And I just found that quite difficult. And for me then, I was always kind of, I suppose not pressure, but you have to blend in at home. Home still goes on whether you're there or not. So you can't jump in. And it can't be Ray Goggins' plan after that then.
Yeah.
It has to be what the family are doing. I just slot in. So it's great, don't get me wrong, but I dealt with it, but it could be difficult sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, I can only begin to imagine, yeah.
As well too, like, you know, everybody wants to see them for that month and, you know, meet this guy, meet that guy, and meet your family, meet your friends, and the 4 weeks are over before you know it and you're back out there, you know. But that's the way it goes, like.
I'm sure I could ask you plenty of questions that you just wouldn't answer because, you know, there's probably... I suppose a loyalty and ethically would feel inappropriate to kind of divulge too much. But I would imagine in your career you've seen a lot, and I'm sure you've been in traumatic situations. How do you deal with that? So when you're coming home, say to your wife and kids, and the normal, like, you know, hearing about the kids and how they're getting on at school and all that kind of stuff, but you've just come from maybe a pretty difficult situation, and maybe you've seen stuff that most of us only see when we put, you know, sit in front of a movie with our, you know, bowl of popcorn.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, it's Afghanistan is that kind of place. You know, it's in vogue at the moment. The last month, people seen it, but, you know, the 3 years I was there, there's stuff happens every day that no one hears about, and like, the casualty rates are off the scale, and it's usually civilians being killed. You know, innocent people just trying to live their lives and get on with their day. So yeah, unfortunately, look, you'd have a lot to deal with there. There's a lot going on. I was involved in one of the biggest truck bombs in Afghanistan. It was like a 7-ton tanker near a place where we worked. So there was 140 people killed and there was like thousands injured. And like trying to explain the carnage of that to people. Now, obviously, I wouldn't talk about this at home. I mentioned it in the book and my wife knew about it, of course, because it was on the news. But trying to deal with that at the time is straightforward because it's the process I mentioned earlier. You just do your process. You break it down. You do things very simply. So you're on purpose, you remain focused on what you're doing at that immediate time. So, for example, recovering people, getting people out, then you're searching for injured, dead, so on and so forth in the next phases. You don't think about what's going to happen next week. You don't think about what happened yesterday. You plan the next 20 minutes, then you move on. That's what you do. So coming back then, talking to people, I guess, I had one kind of, I won't say episode, but one Christmas I was coming home. I was actually in Pakistan at this stage and I was getting 6 weeks off, which was great. But I came home for the 6 weeks and usually I was really focused for the months. I'd work as hard at home as I used to in Kabul to stay focused and be in a good place and have a bit of crack. But I just kind of relaxed a bit too much, I guess. And I probably, for a period of about a week or two, I just struggled a bit. You know what I mean? I wasn't focused. I wasn't good company around the house. Like, you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot with the kids. And again, it being over Christmas, I was probably drinking more. Like, not that I was drunk all the time, but I was having probably a couple of beers and just sitting around and bloody do nothing, you know. But I probably, it was actually Sinead said to me, look, this isn't you, what's the story? So I kind of had to have a bit of a look at myself, and it was the effect of stuff that had happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan that I hadn't dealt with properly. And I did then. I did. I got back to my routine of sorting it out. A couple of days later, I was back on the horse. That was me. But it was a good kind of warning for me to, you need to focus on like your positivity or your mental attitude towards life all the time. Not just like once a week or every month. Like I kind of coined a phrase now for myself, what I do every day now. There's three things I do every day. So I feed my body every day. So if I train, walk, whatever it is, health. I feed my mind every day by learning something new, like getting involved in stuff. And the third most important thing is I feed my soul. And how I do that is stuff that makes me really happy, whatever that is. And like, they're the three things I do now every day, no matter what I'm doing.
And Non-negotiable.
And everyone should do that. Like, give yourself an hour every day. Mm. Give yourself 20 minutes. Go for that walk at lunchtime. Because people underestimate the power of physical activity. It's like, we're animals. We're designed to move. Yeah. And it just releases you from worries. It releases you from concern, you know, anxiety. It all helps.
Yeah.
So that's what I discovered in that time frame, which is good. Now, I knew it before that. I just had to relearn it.
And
we all do it.
Yeah, in different ways. You know, when we hit that crisis point, we realise that maybe we let things slide that were beneficial to us. But so are you able to reset yourself on your own? Are you on your own?
Yeah.
So even in a situation like that, see, I would have, I suppose, again, perhaps making an assumption that you would need to see a therapist, a psychologist, psychotherapist, whatever, to talk through what you had experienced. Because, I mean, PTSD is...
Oh, it is, yeah. And there's plenty of my friends suffer from it, you know, and they've went down that road. For me, personally, like, the army was always very good. And the ranging in particular for, like, you know, what we call after-action stuff. So, you know, your decompression, talking to psychologists, mental health, getting rid of all the demons, moving on, learning the lessons and being good to go. In the civilian world, it's not as good, I guess, but I had my process of doing it myself that I used to do, but I failed to do it in that period of time because I was so focused on having 6 weeks off. I forgot about, like, okay, I need to do this first. Tick that box. I'm ready to go. I missed that box and I just went back and, you know, I wouldn't say I unraveled a bit. I just struggled a bit for a week, 10 days. But I suppose to talk about, like you're saying, with psychologists, like, I haven't spoken to psychologists per se. I have plenty of friends who are psychologists and work on me, I guess. And I have a couple of friends that I talk to. And I find that's the best way for me, in a story kind of way, to deal with it. That's what I do. Not that I have all these mad horrors in my head. Like, I don't. I don't. But it's important to be aware of it and to be able to deal with it. And if you can't deal with it, if I found I couldn't deal with it myself, I'd absolutely seek help. But I have a very good focus point because as a younger boy, I did martial arts for years.
Yeah.
And I found an incredible way to reset my mind from doing that. Because my brother-in-law, Mike, who's an amazing guy, taught me all these fantastic skills as a 13-year-old to, like, not just physical training, but emotional, mental, like, empathy. All these fantastic skills that, like, I write about in the book that, like, yeah, I got a lot of it from the special ops as well, but mainly from his background. And that's how I got that mental strength, I guess, and being able to do that from him.
So you had that in the beginning before you even...
I had a lot of it. I just realised how to use it better as I got older. And I could I explain to someone exactly how to do it now? I probably couldn't, like, you know. But in my head, I know what I need to do. Like, it's you know, I could give some guidance, I guess, but not all of it.
Yeah. I would imagine it's an obvious answer probably to this question, but, you know, I'm sure you're very proud of what you've achieved in your career and what you've done so far, and you're continuing to do, obviously, lots of very interesting work now. But would you have regrets?
Do I have regrets? If I do, they're not big ones. I don't think I have any regrets, because anything I wanted to try, I did. And I don't think I have any regrets.
Yeah. No. And this was a life choice that was, I suppose, really, it was destined for you. It was always going to be, as you said, there was nothing else.
Yeah, there was nothing else. It was just up to me what I did with it. And look, you know, could I have done better? Yeah, of course I could have. Like, did I make loads of mistakes? Absolutely, every 5 minutes. But like...
But you own them.
I own them, yeah, they're mine and are other people's when I pointed at them. But Yeah, like I have no regrets. You know, you heard a story about people on their deathbed saying like they never regret what they did. They regret what they didn't do.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I don't think there's anything that came on the radar for me that I wanted that I didn't do. Yeah. I always tried. Even if I didn't know how to do it, I'd chance my arm. All right. You know, I'd figure it out.
Yeah. What do you think you've learned most from your life in the army in private security?
Being calm.
Okay.
If you remain calm, it's a superpower. It's an absolute superpower for you, first of all, and for everybody around you after that. So when you have a situation where it's like meltdown and there's like madness around you, just people dying, whatever it is, if you can just take that half a second, 2 seconds, to just calm yourself, whatever your techniques is to do that, and instead of having a reaction, have a response. And understand that difference. And it, you first, don't worry about everybody else around you. Take that couple of seconds, get yourself ready, and then, as I said earlier, take that one step, take the next step. Purpose, the small little details, concentrate on that, then you build your confidence. It'll get better, get better, get better. That's what I've learned. So being calm is the key factor in your life.
That's how you described your dad earlier. You
yeah,
said he was
I
calm.
Did. Yeah.
So are you quite like him?
I probably am very like him. I have probably a bit of my mother too, of me too, who's a bit more kind of, you know, passionate, we'd say. So uh-huh. I have a lot of his calm, but I have some of her passion and her kind of force as well, if that's what you want to use, in a good way, you know.
Yeah,
she was, you know, I can be quite kind of, is there an angry man inside me? Of course there is, but he's controlled because of the nature of my work. You have to be that person sometimes, you know,
yeah.
And I can do that.
I believe your mother gave you some really good advice.
She did. Yeah, I said this to on an interview recently where like they talked to all these professors and super people and athletes and they had wonderful like quotes and stuff like that and brilliant. And I said, look, what my mother always said to me is do good things even when no one's looking.
Yeah.
And like if you keep that in your head all your life, like you're in a good place.
It's brilliant advice, isn't it?
It's the best advice I ever got.
But any of us, I think, yeah.
No, for anyone. Like I'm 50 years old now and like, you know, I do this with my kids. We talk about this, and like, if you can do that at all, like, really do it. It's a liberating thing. It empowers you, and
yeah.
it makes you more yourself, like, as well. Instead of like trying to follow something else that you're not, that isn't for you.
Yeah, and I suppose again, it comes back to humility and you know, leaving ego at the door and just being a decent human being.
Yeah, they're the key values.
Totally.
I think people when they see us and you know hear about the Special Force guys, are all thinking like Arnie and stuff. But there's so much of those softer skills are hugely important. Like you mentioned them all, like empathy, like lack of ego, understanding and kindness, which are people
yeah.
don't realize that those little things are so important all our lives.
You're trained to, you know, I suppose, make decisions in a split second, make judgments. You know, it's part of the gig to
yeah.
survive, to make the right call. Does that still apply now? As in, and I spoke about when I met you outside and I was speaking a mile a minute. That's not normally how I am, but it was weirdly, I could hear this voice in my head going, just calm down. And it was a kind of a nervous reaction because
yeah.
I've been watching you on telly. Can you pick that up from people? Can you pick up their vibe kind of straight away?
I can, I think. I like to think my EQ is pretty good and I'm good at, I won't say reading people, but like feeling people or understanding people a little
yeah.
bit. And that's probably a natural thing and that I've kind of helped on with other things. And I can understand when people are a little bit, I won't say nervous, but like aware of now because of who I am. And you meet especially younger people, like they can hardly talk to you sometimes, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
like, don't forget, like when I was a bodyguard for all these people, these, you know, famous people and all this kind of stuff.
Well, let's name drop a little bit because I know you've worked with big companies like MasterCard,
yeah.
you worked with U2.
Yeah.
Do you want to throw out a few other?
Well, it's not, yeah, like just a few other people, like, you know, like Elton John, all these kind of people, odds and ends, you know. But, like, it's not the name. Like, I have to say, like, the MasterCard part of it was fantastic because I used to do their CEO when he came to Europe, and a gentleman, lovely man.
Right.
And his EQ was unbelievable. Oh, my God, super. But, like, he's easy to mind because most people didn't know who he was, and it was great. So you can go somewhere in London and Paris and, you know. Not that many people know, so it's easy to mind. No, Bono, that's a different kettle of fish.
Different animal altogether.
Jesus, yeah. Everyone wants a piece of him. Like,
of course.
Hard work for him, like, you know.
Yeah, and hard work for you then as well.
Well, yeah, look,
you have to be more aware.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. But, like, don't get me wrong. I only did 4 months with them boys. and it was more residential, so it was like, it was pretty straightforward really and interesting. But what I learned in it, like, is, yeah, would I be into looking after someone that famous all the time? I probably wouldn't, but for small periods of time, yeah.
And why? Just
because you just, like, it's not the physical threat of him being hurt or injured, yeah, that's there too, but it's a threat of, like, you know, a shot of him, like, I don't know, in his underpants or something by the poo or whatever it is.
I know what you mean, it's more
a prestige thing, and you're trying to protect his prestige and his privacy more so, which is harder to do, you know. It's really hard to do. It's the hardest part of that security. Like, stopping being hurt is easy. Stopping being embarrassed or, you know, someone taking his privacy is much harder to do.
Yeah, because paparazzi are sneaky.
They are sneaky.
And they'll do everything in their power to get that shot.
They don't care that, you know, these people are in their own private home and doing whatever they're doing on their downtime, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there you go.
So life now is a combination of, I suppose, you know, at the moment you're plugging the book and it's doing brilliantly, and no doubt it'll be in a lot of Christmas stockings this Christmas. And of course, you know, on the back of the TV show, there's talk of perhaps more. And you do your company core skills.
Yeah.
So how does that apply to real life? As in, you know, because what you've learnt through your military training, how can we apply that into regular lives, regular jobs?
So in so many ways, and that's probably the biggest learning thing I've taken from the last couple of years, is how transferable those skills are to everybody. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, for example, I coach an under 14 football team as well, right? And it's like dealing with the Taliban sometimes, the way you have to deal with them. So you have to be very focused. You have to keep them engaged.
Is this your young lads team?
My young lads team, yeah. I give them a hand there, and the soccer team as well. So, like, but it's great crack. But to get back to your question, I suppose, like, I do a lot with companies, individuals, groups about, you know, that teamwork kind of space and what teamwork really is. And, like, high performance is a word that's banded around by people because I think, you know, you have to be at this 100% level. What high performance is that ability to deal with mistakes. That's all it is. It's nothing to do with being perfect. It's actually the opposite.
Yeah.
So you'll find that companies and teams that are high performance, if you did like a scale, they'd have more mistakes than a team that isn't, because they endeavour more, they try better, they chance things more. You know, they're more focused. They're willing to go that extra bit. And that's when the mistakes happen. So that's a big part of what I do with people. And, you know, obviously the resilience piece is huge at the moment. Mindset, focus, all those things like that I learned by osmosis in the military, really, because a lot of the stuff we learned, there was no kind of, yeah, there was a program of training and there's a syllabus for the weapons and the tactics and all this stuff. There's no syllabus of training about, like, dealing with someone, you know, talking with someone, empathy, kindness, you know, all these things. There's nothing in the manual for that. So you kind of learn it yourself by osmosis, and some guys are better than others, obviously. So that's where I picked all that up as well.
And you obviously have it naturally.
I have a certain amount of it naturally, yeah. And like, I think I have.
Yeah.
But it kind of got better dealing with people in, for example, in East Timor, you're dealing with villagers. Like in Africa, you're dealing with people. In Afghanistan, I was working with Afghan people every day, you know. Same in Pakistan. I lived on my own in Pakistan for a year, which is brilliant. So like, I was living in an apartment block with like Pakistani families, fantastic, like lovely people. Like I went to more dinners in people's houses for that year. It was fantastic. It's great crack.
Yeah. So you have something else coming up as well. You're doing a series of evenings with Rory O'Connor.
Who, of course, was in
Hell Week. And I think really, you know, I did a gig with Rory some time ago, and I really liked the guy straight away when I met him. But I think for people who weren't aware and just knew him as Rory Stories, I think that we kind of fell in love with him a lot on the show, and how he wore his heart in his sleeve, and he spoke very truthfully about his struggles with his own mental health. So you guys are going to sit down and be in conversation and talk about a lot of the stuff that I suppose has really impacted a lot of people during the time of the pandemic, which is, you know, struggling with not doing okay, the change and how that has impacted. And the core word, as you said, is resilience.
Yeah, look, Rory's a great guy. And look, I didn't know him before the show, obviously, but he's affectionately number 13 to me forevermore.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, he's a super individual. And we are going to make that step. Like, he comes at it slightly different to me and what we're doing. So I think what we project out to people will be very good, because, like, as you said, people will see me as this kind of robot type person, you know, which, yeah, and some of that's okay too. But they'll see Rory, as you said, as this like absolutely like honest, straight, lovable kind of heart on the sleeve guy, which like disarms people because, you know, there's no bending him. He's completely straight. I'm similar in a way. I'm just kind of more, I suppose, I won't say disciplined, but it's because of my background. I have a different way of coming across. But we will be talking about, like, you know, how people can endure adversity, like on a daily level, not just all the mad stuff I'm talking about. Like those skills in those crisis environments can fall down to smaller things. And like it's a simple routine of like, you know, maybe a 4-point mindset thing in your head and maybe some breathing techniques. And it'll cover 99% of what happens to you in your life, you know, yeah, if you can just get it right.
Yeah.
You know, and like from like the kids, one of the kids jumping out the back window to the fridge blowing up or whatever happens.
Yeah.
Would
yeah.
that drive us all mad?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So with Rory, we saw that he was comfortable. I mean, whether he was or he wasn't, he was upset. Mm. He was crying on camera. And I suppose it's very powerful to see that and see somebody just own their emotion. Do you cry easily?
No.
No.
And I don't mean that as like I'm a hard man. I just don't. It's not necessarily in me. Would I prefer if I did? Probably. It'd
okay.
be better for me. My way of doing that is training. So I train to get that emotion out of me at times. No, but I don't cry easily.
And is that, do you think, again, coming back to training, is it because of your training?
No, I think I'm naturally like that.
As a kid?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. Like I don't, it's not that I frown on it. Like, of course, I think it's a great thing, no matter who you are, to be able to do that, like to be able to express your emotions like that. But like, yeah, I'm not easily a crier, unfortunately.
Yeah, so if you did start crying, you'd be surprised.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be a bit shocked. Jesus. Yeah.
Ray, thanks a million for this chat. You have been, we've only scratched the surface, and I know that the book is it's a fabulous read, but it's still only giving a snapshot into some of the experiences you've had through your career. So continued success. Will be glued to the next series, if there is another series of Ultimate Hell Week.
Yeah, potentially is the word, potentially.
Potentially. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Look, lovely to meet you. Thanks very much. It was a great chat.
If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it with family or friends, and you can show your support on Apple or Spotify by clicking follow, leaving a rating, or even a quick comment. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.